Well, I'm happy to be here today. Thank you. At my age, it's good to be any place, you know? So it's working out okay. I'm going to talk today about Vaisakh. And Vaisakh is the celebration of the Buddha, Siddhartha Gautama. 2,600 years ago, he found his way to Earth again, been reborn many times. And he had a wonderful teaching. So let me tell you how he was born. It's a good story. You might have trouble believing it, but it's been recited and remembered for 2,600 years, so you'll know why. The king married sisters. That's what they did back in the old days. He had a little harem. The king had a little harem. And one night, Queen Maya had a dream. She dreamt of a white elephant with six tusks. And the white elephant entered her body through her side. 9 months later, she realized she had been impregnated, and the future Buddha, Siddhartha, was about to have his birth. So she wanted to go be with her mother. And her entourage and her left the palace and on the way to her mother's house, and she couldn't make it because the baby needed to be born. So they stopped at a sala grove. It said that she grabbed the branch, and he was born out of her side. Now, you know, this signifies a special birth, not scientific. And it said he was able to stand and take seven steps. And under each step that he took, a lotus blossom bloomed. And then he pointed to the heavens, and he pointed to the earth. And that's how he started his final rebirth on Earth. Now, some of the stories about his growing up and becoming a man, I really enjoy because it's talking about compassion and wisdom. And one of my favorite stories is when Siddhartha and Chana went out into the world. They got their chariot. They went through the streets of the city. And it said Siddhartha saw four things that changed his life forever. Because he had been kept secluded. He was behind the palace walls. He was around young people and healthy people and music and beautiful clothing. So he didn't see the realities of what the world had to offer. The first thing he saw was this really sick guy. And Siddhartha said, "Wow. How old is he?" And Chana said, "No, it's not age that troubles him, it's his health." And we all, sooner or later, will get sick, which is why we have health care. And Siddhartha took that as a warning sign, and they continued through the streets of the city, and then they saw this really old guy. And Siddhartha said, "What does he have? What kind of sickness does he suffer from?" Chana said, No. He's not sick, he's old. And everybody that lives long enough will get old." And Siddhartha said, "Whoa." And then they continued through the streets of the city, and they saw this really dead guy, just lying there. And Siddhartha said, "How old is he?" And Chana said, "Age is not his problem. His problem is he's dead. And anybody that's born has to die." Now, can you imagine never having thought about that before? And all in one day, those concepts that we live with, because we're scientific and modern and it's 2026, we never think of those anymore. Siddhartha was just blown away. Now, on the way back to the palace, they saw this other guy, all dressed in white, calm, relaxed, unaffected by what the future Buddha had just seen. And Siddhartha said, How can he be that way? How can he look like that with all the suffering I've just seen? And Chana said, he's a religious person. He's working to find wisdom, insight into the true nature of his life. Now, I think at that point, it planted a seed in the future Buddha's mind that maybe being a religious person is the way to go. Because he had lived at the palace, he was doing fine, but he never thought about those three things and then the religious person. So at the age of 29, he was married now. He had a son called Rahula. Rahula means fetter or impediment. I don't know many parents that would call their child a fetter or impediment. But in the story of the Buddha, it works well. He said to his wife, I am going to find the answer to suffering, and when I do, I'll come back for you. 29 years old, it took him from 29 to the age of 36 to become enlightened. Now, I've been practicing for 32 years. I'm not even close. So I thought to myself, why did it only take him 6 years to achieve nirvana? And I realized it's because he had many, many lifetimes before. So he had been practicing a whole lot before his final lifetime. He went into the forests and the jungles of India and Nepal, met meditation masters, tried asceticism and renunciation, all the things possible to achieve nirvana. Almost there, but not quite. And then one night, full moon night of May, he achieved his nirvana. Now, nirvana is hard to explain. I haven't met anybody who has achieved nirvana or even enlightenment. So, and if I had, and they had told me what it was, I probably wouldn't have had the intuition or the intellect to understand what the heck they were talking about. But the characteristics of nirvana are you never have to suffer again. Cool. It ends your karma. Cool. It ends all future rebirths. Cool. Now, that's a hard sell. I know that when we die, we want there to be some kind of afterlife so the journey doesn't end on that final day. And nirvana is a kind of existence that might be a little bit like heaven, it might be a little bit like this, but I can't describe it. I don't know what it is. But it seems to be peaceful, and it seems to be eternal. And that's cool, eternal peace. It might sound boring if you live in LA, but you know what? It sounds like a good reward to me. So he decided now to teach. And for 45 years, he taught the path to the end of suffering. And then he died. He died at the age of 80. What a nice full life he had. And he died because he ate the wrong kind of food. Now, they say he was poisoned by food. We're not sure if it's pork or a mushroom, but he was invited by one of his followers to the house so he could offer him food. And can you imagine offering the Buddha food and then you killed him? What did that feel like? And the Buddha said to him, this is my best meal because this ends my lifetime on earth. And now I can go to parinirvana, nirvana after life, nirvana in death. So thank you. Don't feel bad. Now, he had a lot of followers. There were hundreds, if not thousands, of followers asking him questions, meditating with him, traveling with him. And the Buddha surrounded himself with the current students and said, does anybody have a question? I'll be leaving soon. I won't be able to answer any more questions. Does anybody have a question? Not one person had a question. Go figure. You know, they didn't realize what was about to happen, really. Now it said, after the Buddha died, 18 schools of Buddhism arose in the world. And those 18 schools of Buddhism all had different kinds of instruction and understanding, and they all thought they knew what the Buddha said. Now today, we only have three schools. We have the Theravada school, Doctrine of the Elders. This is closely linked to the original Buddhism. We have the Mahayana, the Great Vehicle. This is the reform movement of Buddhism. These guys are the Protestants. And then we have a third school of Buddhism, and that's the Vajrayana, Tibetan Buddhism, the mystical. I think of them more like Unitarians, you know? So we have those three schools of Buddhism now that came out of the 18 original schools. So what did the Buddha say? What was his basic message? Well, he talked about the Four Noble Truths. And the first truth is, life is ultimately unsatisfactory. Wow. That means it's never any good? He said, no, there are plenty of times when it's good. But the problem with that is everything changes all the time. So if you like it now, you're not going to like it later. But the other side of that is, if you don't like it now, it'll change. And it'll get better, or it'll get worse. One of the two. That was the first truth. Ultimately, life turns out to be unsatisfactory. The second truth. Why? What's the cause of this unsatisfactoriness? Cause of the suffering? It's craving, attachment, desire, clinging, aversion. It's that mental state where we don't want to let go because I really like it, or it's so bad, I wish it would leave right now. I don't want it anymore. And unfortunately, we are only one of the contributing factors. So we don't really have control over that externally, but we do have control internally. Third truth, Noble Eightfold Path. Big one. Right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right effort, right livelihood, right concentration. Man, these eight path factors. How can you practice them all? Well, you start with the first one, right view. Okay, what does right view mean to a Buddhist? Right view is about karma. Right view is about the Four Noble Truths. You need to explain to yourself what karma is. Now, you can go online. Google can tell you what karma is. That's cool. But karma is one of the most important aspects of Buddhism. And it's not what goes around comes around. It's more than that. Though I liked the bumper sticker in the 60s. In Buddhism, karma takes the place of a divine lawgiver. Now, I know that sounds really sort of iffy, because we're sort of used to having a divine lawgiver deciding for us what is right and what is wrong, and what is the punishment for the wrong. You go, wow, man. So what does karma do? Karma just allows you to have a choice. And it signifies if you're unskillful, not wrong, unskillful, you will suffer more. And if you are skillful, you will suffer less. So we have this reference point we can use to see if we're having a good day, a skillful day, enjoying life and not causing suffering to anybody else, Or we can tell if we're awake and clear and conscious. We can tell if we're not doing skillful things and it's causing us to suffer and it's causing others to suffer. Now remember I said when you achieve nirvana, you end your karma and you end all future rebirths. This is cool now. I couldn't figure it out right away, but this is cool. Karma is what's reborn. That's what goes from lifetime to lifetime, is our past actions, thoughts, and speech. And so you can have good karma and be reborn in Palos Verdes. Or you can have bad karma and be reborn in Koreatown, where I live. Now, Koreatown's okay. It's a busy place. There's a lot of people living there. A lot of traffic. My day starts with sirens and helicopters. My day ends with sirens and helicopters. And in between, there's a little peace and levity that goes on, you know. But it's tough to be in a major city every day. So the idea that we are reborn because of our karma is just amazing to me. Because it's you know, I was thinking to myself, well, why was I reborn? And I've never felt that I had another life. This seems like the only one. But according to Buddhism, I have lived here before many times. And so I came to the conclusion I was reborn because my parents had sex and I had karma. Now, it doesn't sound very romantic or practical, but you know, I'm growing used to that idea. And my parents, when I was born, didn't know what I was going to be or what I was going to do. You know, no parents do. You're hoping for the best. Sometimes it doesn't work out that way. But sometimes they can save themselves halfway through their life and make their parents proud. So I thought to myself, wow, my parents must have just tripped out with me. Because I wasn't a very good kid. And I liked mom. I don't know if you feel this way about your mom, but when my mom took me to kindergarten for the first time, in front of this giant building with bricks and glass and doors, and left me there, I couldn't believe she left me. I'd been with mom every day for my whole life. And then one day she just leaves me. And I walk into the door. All I see are strangers. I see old people. I see average people. I see medium people. I see a lot of young people like me. And some of them are reading and writing. I didn't know what reading and writing was. I was just dropped off. And as time went on, I understood that this is a form of socialization, that we have to live with everybody. We have to be partners with everybody. The ultimate reality in Buddhism is that we're all interconnected and interdependent. So I was meeting my tribe at 4 or 5, however old I was. I got over it. I still loved mom. Mom still loved me. But you know, as you get older, they're less and less attached to you. And then one day they say, okay, the world is yours. Enjoy. But mom, what am I going to do? You got to figure it out, man. You know? And of course we all do. It's just challenging when you're young. But the karma thing was fascinating to me. Now, the Four Noble Truths, right view is the karma, but also understanding what right view is, and that's the karma. Okay? And then there's this thing that you start to look at, and you start to see that because everybody is suffering, and because you're practicing Buddhism, and because now your heart is open, and now you're gonna go out and try to help people. They don't want help. Have you ever tried to tell somebody something? They don't care. I can help you. I can help end your suffering. I'm not suffering. I just got a new car, man. It's beautiful. Okay, you know. So for me, thankfully, I didn't have to go out and seek people who were suffering to try to be of service. Because being of service, as you know, is one of the best things you can do. So the book, Urban Dharma, is about my community service, but I was invited. I was invited to do it, you know? And I thought to myself, well, how lucky was I? Did you know what you were doing, Kusala? No, I just showed up, like kindergarten. And then they told me what they'd like me to do. Did you help anybody? Did you save anybody? No, I just showed up. And then I left and had a cup of coffee. And then I went back the next day. And it just kept going on. But I got into places that most people can't get into. You know, like the police department, ride-along chaplain, cool. You know, and I was invited because I gave a keynote address at the mayor's prayer breakfast. They like what I had to say. But I warned them. I said, you know what? I'm a Buddhist, so I don't pray, but I do eat breakfast. Is that okay? They said, that's fine. We'll help you. Juvenile hall, going to juvenile hall, 5 years. I became the volunteer of the year 1 year. Got a certificate. The cool thing about being a volunteer is they give you a lot of certificates. So I have a wall of me in my room. And then I was at UCLA Medical Center. And I was a chaplain on campus for 12 years. We started a Buddhist club. And, you know, my dislike for school turned out to be 12 years of being of service. How life works. It teaches you what you need to know. And I would give talks to the chaplains at the medical center on Buddhist patient care and end-of-life issues. And they were all really curious because Christian, Jewish, Muslim, and then the Buddhist guy. You know, what does he have to say about afterlife? Nirvana. Well, what the hell is that? I don't know. But as we go through life, we start to collect information so we can die well. Now, most people don't think about dying well. If you ask your minister or rabbi or monk, they're going to tell you how to live. That's their focus. And tell you how to live well, be successful, be relaxed in all the situations you find yourself in. But you go up and ask your minister, what's the best way to die? I bet they're going to have to think about that for a while, because they haven't applied it to themselves yet either. And somebody the other day, yesterday I was at Leisure World in Seal Beach. We have a club, a retired club called the Buddhist Circle. And they're my peer group. And we talk about life and death all the time. And death is one of their favorite topics. You know, I'm going, okay, I got it. Then a woman asked me, is it okay to commit suicide? I said, whoa. Well, there's a monk called Bhikkhu Bodhi, and I asked Bhikkhu Bodhi the same thing. Can a monk commit suicide? And Bhikkhu Bodhi said, well, it's always wrong to kill, but sometimes you might find it to be necessary. But as far as taking your own life as a monk, there's only one way you can do it, and that's to stop eating and stop drinking water and let life kill you. I thought, whoa, man, this is getting deep now. I'm thinking, is this what the Buddhists talk about all the time? Yeah, we do. Because we meditate, and we look in our minds, and we see how messed up they are, and they're all over the place. And just when you think you got it, you don't. And one of the most advanced meditators I know of said to me, I don't know anything. And I've worked 20 years to get there. And, whoa, yeah, okay. So if somebody says they don't know, they're probably very wise. Listen carefully to what the next sentence is going to be. So as we celebrate the life and teachings of the Buddha, it gives us a chance to have community. We gather. Gives us a chance to eat together. We always like to eat together. And it gives us a chance to reflect on our own life and realize that maybe the two pillars of a spiritual life turn out to be compassion and wisdom. And that's an important consideration, because if you have too much wisdom, you may never give a dollar away. If you have too much compassion, you may give all your money away. There's that balance, and Buddhism would call that the middle path. Thank you for listening. You know? Wow.